Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, if you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're revisiting our classic album dissection of the Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street on its 50th anniversary. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. Let's jump in.
Greg and I have written one book together, The Beatles versus the Rolling Stones. It wasn't our idea, it's kind of hokey, but we had fun with it. It was a back and forth comparing these two bands that arguably were the most important groups in the world throughout the 60s. The Beatles break up, and the Stones don't have that pushback anymore from another artist that is always pushing them higher. There's that competition throughout the 60s, in the studio, on stage, both bands making the other better. Where are we at in 1972? The Stones formed in 62. They're a decade into a career. They've been the biggest band in the world, sharing that title with the Beatles, but the Beatles are gone. We are in the post-60s malaise. We think for a moment there's that utopia of peace and love, Woodstock, the 60s, the youth culture, you know, all that stuff you've heard your parents talk about, right? And now the Stones are in the hangover phase, right? Altamont. They watch a man beaten to death in front of them while they're on stage playing Under My Thumb. They have experienced all the highs and lows imaginable. They are the Caligula of our time. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. They're rich beyond description, and they're burned out. They release a fine, fine album, Sticky Fingers, in 71. It's a classic rock record, right? Wonderful hits. Brown Sugar, Can't You Hear Me Knocking, Wild Horses. They're at the peak of their songwriting, and they're in the studio making great recordings. Where do they go now? Brian Jones is dead. He's passed in 1968, the founder of the band. In many ways, their secret weapon all through the 60s never got as much credit as he deserved. Altamont lingers. They are in tax exile. They have made so much money, they can no longer afford to live in the United Kingdom, so they all move to various parts of France. Jagger is busy getting married to Bianca and having their only child together, Jade. Keith is busy with heroin. He's with Anita Pallenberg. They are both in the depths of heroin addiction. You know, where do they go creatively? What's left to prove? What's left to do? You know, what is there left to say in rock and roll? I think that's where Exile on Main Street starts. The title literally referring to them being tax exiles.
Well, and you know, I think it's important to note too, Jim, that they were coming off a run of pretty good records. They had sort of remade themselves with Jimmy Miller taking over as a producer with Beggar's Banquet in 68, Let It Bleed in 69, and then Sticky Fingers in 71, as you pointed out. So they were coming off a pretty good run of really great rock and roll records with Mick Taylor taking over as the second guitarist to Keith Richards.
Filling in for Brian Jones,
right. So, you know, this whole tax exile business, you know, we're exiles in our own country. They go to France. You know, it's not a bad deal to be an exile in France in a villa,
I could live with that. I could live with that.
You know, so here's this $10,000 a month villa that Richards is renting. And Ian Stewart, who is sort of the piano player slash roadie slash
gopher. Dead mother, soul of the band. Their best mate.
He does everything. His job, he's enlisted to find a place to record this new album in France. He settles on Keith Richards' basement at the villa.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody's kind of looking at him like, really? But it did have a tremendous advantage. The band's least controllable member was on the premises at all times.
24/7. So, wasn't always conscious, Keith, right. 24/7. Have we ever nailed this down? I mean, I don't think we managed to for the book. It has been said, and this may be apocryphal, that Nel Cote had been the Gestapo headquarters in Nice.
Well, apparently Keith told that story, and a couple of the engineers in the recording session have verified it. In fact, there were gold-plated swastikas in the heating vents in the hallways. Ooh. So there was some residue of Nazi occupation in this villa.
So you shouldn't be thinking beach house.
No.
You should be. Apparently the basement was dank and damp and foreboding. Not a wonderful place to be a clubhouse.
They wrote a song while they were there called Ventilator Blues, which was basically an ode to the one fan in the window in that basement that tried to keep that place ventilated.
So, Greg, as we're saying, an incredibly dense and complicated record, a double album, 18 songs. I think the best way for us to begin to get a handle on the magic and the murk of Exile on Main Street is to talk about some of the tunes. I'm going to talk about the very first track on the album, and later I'll talk about the penultimate track. It opens with a song called Rocks Off. If we look at the lyrics, this is Keith writing about heroin addiction. I'm zipping through the days at lightning speed, plug in, flush out, and fire the blanking feed, heading for the overload, splattered on the dirty road, kick me like you've kicked before. I can't even feel the pain no more. I think it's about more, though. He's talking about blissing out on heroin. He's talking about not having a voice. At the same time, the rhythm is ferocious and driving forward. This is the hardest rocking song on the album. The guitar riff is one of the all-time great Stones guitar riffs. And then we have this psychedelic breakdown in the middle of the song. That I think we argue about this in our book. I love Their Satanic Majesty's Request. I don't think the Stones were only dabbling in psychedelia or making fun of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's. I think the darkness, you know, there is good trip psychedelia. Mm, yeah. There's bad trip psychedelia. Right. Here we have this bad trip in the middle of the song, this weird breakdown. And then it kicks in again. It all builds to the choruses. I can only get my rocks off while I'm dreaming. You are among the richest, most famous, most fabulously successful people in the universe. You are a Roman emperor. You are Caligula. Mm-hmm. And you've had every pleasure that's imaginable, mm-hmm. that's available. And now you can't even imagine pleasure anymore except when you're dreaming.
Right.
What an awful place to be. Where do you go from there? And that's where they start the album. Your mouth don't move, but I can hear you speak. What's the matter with this boy? He don't come around no more. Is it checking out for sure? Is it gonna close the door, man? I'm always hearing voices on the street.
That's Rocks Off by the Rolling Stones, the track that kicks off Exile on Main Street, their classic 1972 album. Jim, You know, you mentioned that that's the hardest rocking song on the album. I think it's a close contender with that and the following song, Rip This Joint.
Yeah, that's pretty ferocious, too.
Might be the fastest song they ever recorded. In fact, it was so fast that some of the band was looking at Charlie Watts and Keith Richards like, what are you doing? You know, this is just like hyperspeed music.
Well, and you get the sense that Jagger's not really keeping up.
Yeah, it's, you know, and then there's songs like All Down the Line, Happy, Tumbling Dice. I mean, this is a great rock album. If you just isolated those rockers and put them on a single album, you know, people would have said this is the Great Stones rock record.
No, you're right. It would have been the equal of Sticky Fingers, its predecessor.
But they spread those rockers across four sides of music, and there's a lot of texture in this record, and I want to sort of focus on some of those tracks that explore the avenues that the Stones were just beginning to really explore during this period. You know, particularly Keith Richards' dalliance with country music and his fortuitous meeting with Graham Parsons the previous year. He was really enamored with Graham and, you know, Graham's passion for country music. Because I don't think the Stones and Keith in particular had taken country music all that seriously, even though it was a very close cousin to their beloved blues.
Yeah.
But when people like Graham Parsons entered their life and sort of educated them about the nuances of great country music,
well, and Graham
they started
Parsons,
to pay attention.
You know, for people who don't know, Graham Parsons is generally considered now the godfather of alternative country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not hokey Nashville country, but real gritty country, and pairing that with rock.
It seems like this whole
right, Flying Burrito Brothers, and also bringing the country nuances to the Birds in Sweetheart of the Rodeo.
Yeah.
So around this period, Graham Parsons was kind of the it boy in rock and roll circles. He was really influencing a lot of the rockers.
Not selling any records, but influencing
no.
other artists.
But also a heroin addict. You know, he spent a few months at Nelcote. Eventually, get this, you know, amidst all that iniquity that was going on there, all that decadence, Graham Parsons was even too unruly for that place. They kicked him out. They go,
yeah, how bad
you're just a bad dude. But meanwhile, his influence is deeply felt on this record. And I don't mean to diminish Graham at all as a musician and as an artist. He was an incredibly gifted guy. And Keith was right to hang around him from the musical standpoint. So you hear a song like Torn and Frayed. And here's a song that, you know, it's really a Keith song. I mean, Mick sings it. But here's a Keith song, and in some ways, you know, is it Mick singing about Keith, or is it Keith writing about Graham Parsons?
Mm.
And are Keith and Graham really the same person? I mean, has anybody actually seen them in the room together? You know, it's kind of one of those kind of deals. They really became, you know, two peas in a pod, to overstate a cliche. But, you know, they were linked at the hip there for a year and a half. Richards, to this day, lauds Parsons for teaching him about the Everly Brothers and those cross harmonies.
I can make you mine, taste your lips of wine anytime, night or day.
And you can hear that attempt at harmonizing here in Torn and Frayed. It is, just as the song says, Torn and Frayed. Those harmonies that Keith sings sounds like some guy that just walked in off the street and decided to sing along with whatever was going on.
After a 16-hour bender.
Yeah, and you know, people are like, oh, that's so off and so wrong. but it fits the vibe of this record perfectly. And it's a beautiful song. They bring in one of Parsons' friends, Al Perkins, a very excellent pedal steel guitar player, added pedal steel to this song and adds to the country vibe of it. Between that and those ragged harmonies, but also what the song is talking about, this raggedy troubadour. Nobody wants to look at him. He looks like he's just a smelly street bum. But then when he starts to play his guitar, that's going to steal your heart away. That's what the song says. And I think, you know, Keith was really talking about himself in a lot of ways. You know, not just Graham, but himself. That at the soul of this record, it was a musical soul. You know, people talk about the heroin and the decadence, but it was about those guitars and about those voices making this beautiful noise in that basement. When we return, more from our discussion of Exile on Main Street. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And that is a bit of Happy by the Rolling Stones from the 1972 immortal album Exile on Main Street. I've been living with this album since, I don't know, 14 or 15, and I still haven't plumbed its depths.
Jim, you can't talk about this album without talking about the unconventional way it was recorded, which resulted in that signature vibe.
Title 5, take 1.
So this recording session in this basement, mythical, myth-making moment in the band's history and rock and roll history, what was that really all about? They parked their mobile studio outside of the house. Immediately there's problems because there's the communication between the mobile studio and the basement is non-existent. They can't communicate. They can't talk to the band. The communication system is all off. So the engineers in the recording studio have to run out and tell the band when to start and stop. I mean, it is the most
crude. Efficient.
Here's the biggest band in the world, and they can't even set up a decent studio apparatus.
I wouldn't mind that for Sound Opinions, though, if our producers couldn't talk to us.
It's amazing. I'm sure the Stones were probably like, you know, careful what you wish for, one of those kind of scenarios. The ventilation was so bad, as we pointed out. It was dark and dank. It was in the summer. It was very hot down there. The instruments kept going out of tune. And the band would tell these stories about trying to get through tunes quickly before the instruments went out of tune. So there was all these issues. Then there was a mixing issue where Jagger's vocals never seemed to be very clear. They always seemed to be buried in the mix. So there were all these issues with the recording. They had become vampires because the daytime was so stinky and hot that they started recording at 8 o'clock and recorded all through the night. They were literally vampires.
Yes.
The sunshine bores the daylights out of me. That's where that line comes from.
There are the ancillary members of the Stones. Bobby Keys, Jimmy Miller is around, and he's playing drums on some tracks.
Yeah.
So you often don't even have all of the Stones on these recordings.
Well, that's the thing. That we're running on Keith time here, and Charlie Watts would tell stories like Keith would just sit in a chair for 12 hours and play a riff over and over again, and the band would sort of come in and out around him. Then finally Keith nods off, everybody leaves, and then one of the engineers would get a call an hour later, and Keith would be saying, "Where'd you go?" You know, I just came up with a counterpoint riff, and it was kind of this methodology that Keith was using to record. And apparently he did this very quite a bit during early in his career, where he would just play a chord almost hypnotically over and over again, or a riff over and over again. And then emerging from that haze, like, what's he doing? Why is he doing it for so long? Would be a counterpoint melody that he would come up with. And suddenly a song would be born.
You see that really effectively in the Godard movie, Sympathy for the Devil, when the title track, that song, comes together out of this aimless, wandering jam. And you're like, what are they doing, wasting our time? And Godard lets the whole scene unplay, and you see a song born.
You know, it was an odd way to make a record, for sure. It was a trying method. It was driving Mick Jagger nuts because the producer, Jimmy Miller, was falling under Keith's wing. They were both doing heroin. Mick was upset with the way the recording sessions were going in terms of just what he heard in the mixes, which is one reason why, even though a lot of weight is put on Nelcote as the core of Exile on Main Street, and it was. There were additional recording sessions after that long, hot summer of 71. They went to L.A., and the idea was to mix the record in L.A., but not only did they mix the record in Los Angeles afterward, but they added quite a bit to the record. They did additional recording. Yeah. They brought in a gospel backing vocalist. There was a whole other recording session in Los Angeles after the recording sessions in France.
Except
so we really have these two main recording sessions.
The basic tracks, though, always sounded like that damp, dark basement.
Yeah, the murk was there.
They couldn't get rid of it.
And people say, well, what did Mick Jagger exactly do for this record? Well, first of all, I think some of Mick's greatest vocal performances are on this record, despite the fact that Jagger himself hates the vocal mix on this record.
He hates this record.
Yeah. But at the same time, some of the most excellent performances in his career are on this record.
Yes.
And he also, what he did in Los Angeles, when they came back to Sunset Sound to ostensibly mix the record, ended
up
expanding the recording sessions, adding songs to the record, expanding it into what became a double album. Jagger really took over. I think he no longer trusted Jimmy Miller because Jimmy Miller, who had been producing them and doing a great job, was really hooked on heroin and was not really able to steer the ship the way that Jagger felt it needed to be steered at that point.
Well, you also have to realize the Stones are a battle for supremacy throughout their entire career.
Mm.
At any given moment, Jagger may be ascendant because Keith is smacked out. Or Keith is ascendant because he's clean and Jagger's going through one of innumerable divorces.
Mm-hmm.
It is a partnership like Lennon and McCartney, but it's far more of a rivalry. And whoever's driving at the time. So Keith had been driving. It was his basement, right? He loves this record. Jagger hates this record. Jagger's going to try to take back some control in Los Angeles.
And he adds some sweetening, you know. But the sweetening is not like, you know,
it's not sweet.
It's the Stones doing their version of sweet.
It's like you're putting icing on a rotten cheeseburger.
So Jagger, he's enamored with gospel music. He has been for a number of years, but he goes to see Reverend James Cleveland's services in Los Angeles while they're in Los Angeles. And he's deeply moved by this. And he hires some of the singers that he sees as part of this gospel scene in Los Angeles to be a part of this record. So people like Clydie King and Vanetta Fields and Tammy Lynn and Shirley Goodman, Joe Green, Dr. John also happens to be in the area, so they bring Dr. John in. The song Let It Loose, to me, is the underrated moment in this record where everything sort of bottoms out. And the narrator, the person who's sort of been living through this hell, bottoms out. And nothing is left. He's at the edge of his bed. The room is dark. No one's there. And he finally lets it loose. The tears start to come. He's sobbing uncontrollably. He's gone through a really rough ride, and it finally hitting him. This British veneer that you can't let your emotions out suddenly explodes when he's all by himself. You know, those opening lines always get me. Who's that woman on your arm?
Dressed up to do you harm.
Ostensibly about a woman, right? But I think it's Mick singing about Keith's heroin habit. I think it's about the heroin that, in Mick's mind, nearly sabotaged these recording sessions. Because Mick stayed off that hard stuff. They were all drug users. You know, Jimmy Miller, Keith Richards, Bobby Keys, these guys were neck deep in that
Charlie
stuff.
Even Charlie Watts.
Yeah, these guys were neck deep in it. And I think Mick saw his band falling apart before his eyes.
Mick, the graduate of the London School of Economics.
Yeah.
He wants to maintain some control.
Absolutely.
It's a corporation. We have our own Rolling Stones records now.
Absolutely. So you hear this beautiful, heart-wrenching song. I think it's one of Mick's most vulnerable and most impassioned vocal performances. The other element of this song that I think is really cool, and for the longest time I thought it was a keyboard or a Hammond organ, because you hear those Leslie amplifiers being used. Those are the guitars. Keith Richards and Mick Taylor are pumping their guitars through Leslie amplifiers.
So you get this Leslie,
sort of watery quality to the chords.
The Leslie speaker is a speaker inside a giant wooden cabinet that revolves. And so it gives this vibrato and this distortion. And, you know, you hear it on the Beatles' Tomorrow Never Knows.
Yeah.
It's a great, weird sound.
Spooky. You know, it's a spooky gospel song. So here are the Stones taking gospel and take it in someplace else where it hasn't been. It's in that basement.
Maybe you're not where the Lord wants it to go.
They're recording the final mix of this in L.A., but this is still in that basement in Nelco.
Let It Loose by the Rolling Stones on Sound Opinions. Greg, we could literally do every one of the 18 songs on this album. And then there's the reissue a couple of years back that had added more songs.
Yeah.
I think it's also worth noting, Greg, that some of these songs went back way before 68, some to 64. You know, the Stones at this time had a very fractious relationship with their manager, Alan Klein. And he was suing them. They were suing him. There were songs that they thought were good that they wanted to keep out of his grip.
Right.
Exile on Main Street is the 10th of their career, their first double album. They're 10 years into this career. You know, we have this idea in our heads that Exile on Main Street is so much of a piece. But as you say, two recording sessions, some songs dated way back. It is of a piece. There is a sound on this album. It is an album that has been elevated to the level of greatness because of a consistent sound that starts on the first song, doesn't end till the last. It is a sprawling mess of a record that is somehow very consistently of a piece. My rock critic hero, Lester Bangs, reviews the album upon its release. And he says it is emblematic of the ennui and the inarticulate energy and frustration of the time. He quotes that line, "I want to shout, but I can't hardly speak." He hates it. He dislikes it. He says it's the worst studio album the Stones have ever made. Then he listens 20 or 30 or 40 times more. And in the very next issue of Cream Magazine, he says, it's the best album the Stones have ever made. Hard to hear at first, the precision and fury behind the murk ensure that you'll come back, hearing more with each playing. It's an album about casualties and partying in the face of them. The party is obvious. The casualties are inevitable. So this is a hard album. If you've never heard it before, you ain't going to get it the first 10 times.
Yeah, you know, that whole idea of the sound was so off-putting to people. Jimmy Miller said, you know, we took convenience over sound. It was easy to make the record there, and we didn't really care what it sounded like. And initially, that took critics aback. Here was an environment in which the work and the play, the socializing and the record making just became a blur. You could not dissociate the fact that Graham Parsons and William Burroughs and all these junky friends of Keith Richards were hanging out from the music.
Yeah.
There's an incident that happened at Nelcote in France. They hired this top-line chef. And the band got up too late to eat any of his food, and you know, Keith would ask for a hamburger, and there was this, you know, gourmet
plate left out. I was going to say, the Rolling Stones ate?
Yeah, they didn't care about that kind of stuff. So the chef leaves disheartened after a couple of months. Keith hires a couple of the buddies that he made in nearby Nice to do the cooking for the band. While the band is on holiday, they go up to Paris for a long weekend to just take a break from the recording. The guys who were there hired to be their chefs steal all their gear, their guitars, the saxophones. Keith buys Bobby Keys a whole new set of saxophones after that. So Bobby Keys came out ahead. For the Stones, money was nothing. But at the same time, there was this dissolute atmosphere, and that really seeped into the recording. You know, some of the reviews were, you know, as you said, not very nice. The Rolling Stones at their most dense and impenetrable. That was the Rolling Stone review. A catastrophe of sloppiness, another one said. But in retrospect, I think we see this record now. At least I do. This is a visit to the dark side of all the music that interested the Stones almost from day one.
Yes.
Blues, soul, early rock and roll. They
country.
They even make gospel sound kind of Stonesy in their own kind of lurid way. You know, it sounded like a record that served as a soundtrack for like a Pulp Fiction novel.
Got to sleep like an angel. Got to be not good. Got to sleep like an angel. Up upon the mile one. Well, she ain't no sing bop. She ain't no stop. But she sure does good. And she moves so fast. But the gal in danger. Yeah, the gal in chains. But you keep on pushing. Would you take a bit?
I'm going to share. Perhaps I'm going to overshare. When I'm in college, I make a road trip with a buddy from New Jersey to an art school in Reading, Pennsylvania, and he had a paramour there, you know. And he dumps me. He takes off with her, and I take a psychedelic substance, the big one, okay, and sit watching a white noise on a TV screen for about 10 hours waiting for him. And then we get back in the car, and we're going to head back to New Jersey, and we're driving down this road. It's a country blacktop in the farm, and there's cows and stuff, right? There ain't no cows in Jersey City. We're in this idyllic situation of rolling green hills. The sun is coming up. We're driving into the sun. The sun is rising. It's beautiful. And we had a boombox, and we only had one tape. We had Exile on Main Street. And we're listening to Shine a Light, the penultimate song on the album. And we just keep playing it and playing it and playing it. And we're driving in the sun. We got to West Virginia when we realized we were going the wrong way, the opposite way from New Jersey. And then, boy, were we screwed. There is a hint of redemption, a hint of the promise at the end of all of this decadence and murkiness. It's the second to last song on the album. It's followed by one more tune, Soul Survivor. We made it through. We somehow came out the other end. But Shine a Light, pulling on those gospel influences. You know, may the good Lord shine a light on you. Make every song you sing your favorite tune. We've somehow come out the other side. To me, the story of Exile on Main Street is, you know, like Dante, the Inferno. We're going through all the different circles of hell, and then we don't wind up burning in eternity. We have hope because we have this music. Make every song you sing your favorite tune. There is redemption. You know, I'm still getting goosebumps now with the fact, you know, as you know, I believe that your life can be saved by rock and roll. You can go through some horrible dark places, and then you come out the other side. Coming up, we'll talk about Exile's lasting influence on the music scene. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot here with my partner, Jim DeRogatis. And today we've been talking about Exile on Main Street, that classic 1972 Rolling Stones album. Now, as we talked about earlier, you know, a lot of critics panned Exile when it was originally released, but some of those critics eventually warmed up to the record. It has become regarded as a masterpiece in subsequent decades. In addition to becoming critically acclaimed, the album's also been used as a reference point by a lot of bands, many generations of bands who are working in a variety of subgenres, sort of the post-Exile generation. They got off on the fact that this was an outlier, even in the Stones catalog. You know, that dirty, murky, off-the-cuff kind of vibe that they got in that recording studio. The idea that you could attack all these different genres of music and make it your own with just guitar, bass, and drums. You know, saxophone, obviously some keyboards. But essentially the core rock and roll instruments being used to make this really ambitious, wide-ranging masterpiece without being too precious about any of it.
Well, you know, you think about the band's music from Big Pink, right? And there's a celebration of all that had preceded Dylan and the band in American music, but it's kind of a good time, folky hootenanny vibe. Whereas Exile on Main Street is the meaning of the satanic ritual, you know, in dark robes with unspeakable deeds being done in the middle of the night in the dark. All down the street. I think there are several ways to look at the influence of Exile on Main Street. Number one, I think when any rock band and producer want to say, let's get dark and dirty and mysterious and a little bit frightening right now, they say, give me some Exile, right? I mean, so there's a shorthand in the recording studio. That's number one. Number two, there's the kind of thematic, we are now hitting rock bottom. You know, addicts and alcoholics talk about you have to bottom out before you can begin to reclaim life and journey toward the light. And this is, I think, the one album in rock history that sums that up best. So when a songwriter is thinking, I'm going to tell about this rather harrowing journey, but there is light at the end, they say, give me some Exile.
Yeah.
So give me some Exile lyrically. Give me some Exile sonically. Let me talk for a minute about the bands that have been influenced. I think John Spencer of the John Spencer Blues Explosion is key here, as is Neil Haggerty, the guitarist in Royal Trucks. Their first band together, Pussy Galore, key to the 80s noise rock sound, fellow travelers with Sonic Youth. They had Sonic Youth's old drummer, Bob Burt. They covered Exile on Main Street in its entirety.
Yeah.
I think it was a cassette-only release. I got to go dig mine out. We hear a lot of Exile at times, not always, in The White Stripes. Well, I hope they got some shining for me. Anybody got a Christmas tree? I got your bottle with a toilet seat. A jump up, a jump up, a jump up. Come on and give it to me. Rock and roll. We want to get it clean while it's hot. In The Strokes, for better or worse, in The Black Crowes, The Hives, Giant Sand. So there are times when all of these bands and many, many others are dialing in that sound or that attitude. It was interesting that in Chicago, at the height of the alternative discovery of Chicago, you know, the Smashing Pumpkins are on top of the charts and Urge Overkill, there was a lot going on in the underground, specifically inspired by Exile on Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Liz Phair,
yeah,
another Chicagoan. Her debut album, Exile in Guyville. Guyville's the name that hipsters in the 90s gave Wicker Park. Wicker Park, made famous by Nelson Algren, Man with the Golden Arm. Heroin addicts used to hang out in Wicker Park. Now there's a lot of expensive restaurants we can't afford to eat at. Liz Phair, in a brilliant move to suck up to rock critics like you and me and all the rest, says that her debut, Exile in Guyville, is a song-by-song response answer record to the Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street. Everybody reprints this. Everybody like loves this. I've never heard that. I think Exile in Guyville is a great record. I think Exile on Main Street is a great record. I don't think they're connected, but that was a nice bit of marketing on Liz's part.
Yeah, yeah.
We also had a great band here that grew out of the ashes of another good band. Friends of Betty became a band called Red Red Meat.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tim Rutili, the leader of that band, became the leader of Caliphone. All of these bands, which at various times worked with producer Brian Deck and Brad Wood, they were emulating the weird sound, the weird, murky, basement sound of Exile on Main Street, but also the American music canon, the weirder little things that were held in grandma's trunk in the attic, right? Mm-hmm. That kind of music. You know, the Stones are doing it from the British perspective, but here was bands, in America. Red Red Meat weren't the only one, but they were going to those strange sounds of folk and blues and country. And bringing them into the modern era.
No doubt about it. I mean, the influence of this record is wide and deep. I mean, even relative contemporaries, bands who just came up right after the Stones' heyday, you know, a band like Aerosmith, a band like the New York Dolls,
were really influenced
by the vibe, the look, the feel of the Stones with those rough guitars. You know, later on, I think any album, any band that, had the ambition, especially a band from kind of the wrong side of the tracks that decided to make a double album, they couldn't ignore Exile on Main Street, you know? It was one thing, you know, the White Album was an important double album, but I don't think any band felt like we can make our White Album. But
yes, we can
do something like Exile and, Exile on Main Street.
It must be said, it also has been cited to apologize for innumerable lousy-sounding four-track cassette releases.
Right.
Anytime you have a record that sounds like thoroughly unmitigated crap, you say, I was going for Exile on Main Street.
I was going for that Exile vibe. But, I think The Clash's London Calling owes something to Exile on Main Street. Wilco, I talked a bunch to that band around the time that they made Being There, and that was in the back of their brains when they were making that record. And I also think a band like The Replacements, those first four or five Replacements albums, including Let It Be, have a very much of a murky, Stonesy vibe about them. Going into contemporary bands, early Kings of Leon, we can laugh about them now, but back to those early Kings of Leon records. They are heavily influenced by the Stones during this period.
Watch the bodies. No room for make-up. I think he's tasted.
A band like the Black Keys in their early days, influenced by that blues vibe that the Stones were getting. The influence of the Stones, in particular from this era, runs wide indeed.
It must be said, we say this in our book, The Beatles versus the Rolling Stones, that the Stones have now not made a good album since Some Girls in 1978. You'll argue with me about one or two after that. But really, the last brilliant album,
that's
1978. They have now sucked three times longer than they were great. But do you remember when we saw them play the Aragon Ballroom, 4,500 seats, right?
Sure.
You know, the problem with the Stones, we both say, is that they have easily 100 of the greatest rock songs ever recorded in the canon, but they always play the same 15.
You're right.
Over and over. Brown Sugar, Honky Tonk Woman, over and over. Jumpin' Jack Flash, right? That night, they did 7, 8, 9, 10 songs from Exile in a row. Do you remember that night?
Yeah, I think they started with like 9 songs they either never played live or only very sparingly played live.
Yeah.
It was just an amazing revelation of what that band was still capable of. Yeah.
I still care about the Stones because there's always a possibility that
we
will get that again.
Yeah.
And if not, this album is immortal. That wraps up our conversation about the Rolling Stones' classic Exile on Main Street. And now we want to hear from you. What is your favorite song on Exile? Leave a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Mr. Cott, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we are going to play our favorite songs that ask questions.
And what?
Yeah, exactly. You got the gist of it.
Do you believe in magic?
And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed for an interview Jim did with artist Steve Keen about his work with bands like Apples in Stereo and Pavement.
Yep, we're going to talk visual art on the airwaves. For more Sound Opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors.
And speaking of sponsors, every week our show reaches hundreds of thousands of curious listeners from around the globe via podcast and on 150 public radio stations nationwide. If you'd like to learn more on how your business or organization can also reach this engaged and educated audience, you can email sponsor@soundopinions.org. That's sponsor@soundopinions.org.
Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our social media consultant is Katie Cox.